Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our live broadcast. Tonight we are going to go straight into questions and answers. We just had our volunteer meeting, so I didn't actually research something to talk about tonight. I could come up with something off the top of my head, but I think we'll just keep it short tonight. Answer people's questions and early. I do this every night, so it's not like you're gonna be missing out. Be back again tomorrow. So Robin's having sound issues, I think, unfortunately. So if and when you're able to talk, go ahead. But until I hear you, I will start off the questions. Does acceptance arise from dispassion? Acceptance isn't exactly what we want, you see. We don't use the word acceptance that much, because it's not exactly, it's not at all really what we are. It's improper, it's incorrect. It's an improper description of the goal. We're not accepting anything. You might, I mean, santutim is probably the closest. Sang means with, and tutti means happiness. So it means being happy with what you have, kind of. But that doesn't refer to, you might argue that that's acceptance, but that's just one, you know, quality that, and way of describing the Buddha's teaching. Acceptance is not the core value. Dispassion leads to turning away, actually, discarding. We don't accept anything about the universe. We discard everything about the universe. We dismiss it as meaningless, pointless, of no consequence, of no value. The only thing we accept the truth about reality. And I mean, maybe it's just nitpicking, because it is to some extent an acceptance in terms of not getting upset. But it's not an acceptance exactly, because you're still clear in your mind that there's no benefit to the universe, to any aspect of samsara. So it's really a rejection of samsara, and it's that rejection which brings about or creates the conditions for the realization of Nibbana. It only comes about not by acceptance, but by rejection. The moment before realizing Nirvana is a moment of realizing that reality is impermanent, unsatisfying, uncontrollable, and rejecting it. So I guess it just means to be a little bit careful with the word acceptance. But some form of acceptance could be seen as coming about from that process, in the sense of giving up your ambitions, accepting that you're not ever going to get stability, satisfaction, or control from samsara, and thereby giving up. But it's more about giving up than accepting. Acceptance, the preceding cause of loving kindness. Well, that kind of accepting people as they are, right? I mean, equanimity is caused by acceptance, in the sense of accepting that people are the way they are and that you're not going to change them. Equanimity is the big one. Metta, friendliness or loving kindness. The cause of that is seeing a potential for people to be happy, and thinking about a thought of someone obtaining happiness, and as a result you feel happy, or you feel a desire for them to be happy in a sense, an inclination for their happiness, for them to obtain the happiness. But acceptance is what leads to equanimity. If someone's just a terrible, horrible person, you might try to help them or alleviate the problem, but if you can't, then you accept, in a sense, and have equanimity. You accept that you can't change them. No, didn't well, we had this one? No? Could I replace formal practice with just sitting down, doing nothing, and noting? We had that last night. Are we going to use this site anymore? No, this site is closing down. Unfortunately, I'm actually kind of fond of the layout of this site, having it all on one page as opposed to the tabs. But the new site is going to supersede this. So if you have complaints about the UI, if you'd rather see it look some other way, you know, talk to us on GitHub. I don't think there's even a link, but I'll post the link here, and then you guys can hang on to this link, because I'm posting issues. You have to learn about a little bit about GitHub. Here's the issues page. So you go there if you have an issue with the new site. Not this site, the new site that we're working on. Robin, you're still mute. Yeah, I don't hear you. I see your lips moving. No sound coming out. Mundy posted a really long joke. Fortunately, I don't have time to read it. Regarding your talk yesterday, I was wondering what makes a person greater, equal, less to someone, right? Well, you could say even worldly matters, worldly affairs would count. Like if someone is richer. No, that wouldn't work, would it? Well, yeah, suppose someone has a lot of money and thereby thinks of themselves as greater than another person. That's conceit, right? If I've got a lot of money and I look at a poor person and say, huh, I'm greater than them. That conceiving of being greater, even though they're not greater. We could argue that money, from a Buddhist point of view, doesn't make someone greater, and therefore here's a case of someone thinking they were greater when they're not actually greater. On the other hand, you could have someone who is pure of mind, right? They're kind and generous and compassionate, and they're wise, but they might have low self-esteem, and they might be always worried about, they might have the fault of being worried about bad things they do, and so they look at someone else who's very confident, say, and who appears to be who does bold acts of goodness or something, and they think, wow, that person is better than me, that person is better than me because of how confident they are or something like that. But in fact, you might argue that, well, the confidence is actually potentially a detriment to that person, and maybe it's associated with ego, so they might actually not be better. On the other hand, a person can be a very good person and know it, and can become conceited about it, and they look at people who are evil and mean and nasty and think, huh, I'm better than that person. They are better than them. It's still conceit. So what really makes a person greater, lesser, and equal is in regards to their goodness, their purity, the good qualities of Buddhism. Does someone regularly give rise to greater ones. You know, is someone a sotapanna, sakadagami, anagami? Even a sotapanna can be conceited about it. Yes, I can.
Is it breaking up or anything?
No, it's great.
Okay, thank you. One day, 9+ years ago, when I started meditating, my first teacher taught standing, but also rupa stands, rupa sits, and so on. I never saw any fault in that. Now, when the mind falls back into this old way of noting, it feels or seems like the mind is creating a separate idea or entity for the label rupa. What are your thoughts on noting standing versus rupa stands? Yes, of course, I've read your booklet. I'm puzzled because you're both Mahasi teachers.
Mahasi Sayadaw seemed somewhat critical of that sort not exactly critical, but dismissed the idea that that was necessary. One of his books, one of the sort of well-known, you can read through it, I could find it for you if you like, discusses this and says, you know, the Buddha said, I go, in fact, kachami, I stand, ditomhi. And he talks about whether you need to actually talk about rupa or say, you know, air element or that or rupa or that kind of thing. And I would agree, you know, even if he wasn't the Mahasi Sayadaw, I would still agree, because it's somehow intellectualizing, you know? I mean, it's not something you have to remind yourself about. The rupa is the experience. The experience is of rupa. You know, when you say standing, you're aware of the rupa standing. But as soon as you say rupa, you're introducing some sort of theory in the sense of what is rupa, or this being rupa, or that kind of thing. It's not necessarily wrong, but I would bet that anyone who does that could have the potential for, especially if they know what rupa is, could have the potential for over-intellectualizing. Now, if you say you've done it and it works, and it worked for you, I mean, yeah, it probably does work fine. It's not what I would recommend for that reason, because you're adding, as you say, you're adding an extra concept. And there's a potential for distraction over analyzing and intellectualizing, that kind of thing. You want to keep it as simple as possible. Standing is fine. Standing is, I would argue, better. It seems that the Buddha was, you know, if you read this, it's ditomhi, I'm standing. Which, you know, people would say, oh, you can't say I'm standing, but the Buddha did, so. It's just the simplest way to say standing.
Is it dangerous to practice other types of meditation while also practicing mindful meditation, not at the same time?
Well, you can look up my video on other meditation types. I think that's what it's called, other meditation techniques or something. There are 4 protective meditations. Hopefully there's actually one out there that's labeled protective meditations. There's 4 types of meditation that actually support your insight practice. Other types of meditation, probably not so much. So I would recommend sticking to those 4 if you wanted something that actually was going to be useful to augment your meditation practice. Practice from time to time these other 4 meditations. They are, you know, you look up the video, but they're quickly mindfulness of the Buddha, mindfulness of not in any particular order, mindfulness of loathsomeness of the body or the aspects of the body, loving kindness, and mindfulness of death. You could argue that like compassion it goes along with loving kindness and mudita and equanimity as well. But those 4 are the big ones.
I have read chapters 1 and 2 of your booklet, and I'd like to understand what you think is the larger goal of why we practice the 4 foundations of mindfulness. Is it to develop a clearer awareness continuously with what we can use to investigate on phenomena and see the characteristics in meditation?
You know, that sounds good, and it's probably okay, but I wouldn't overthink it. The goal is just to, well, the goal state, you know, that of that's the practice state, is to just see things as they are, plain and simple, and thereby see impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and uncontrollability. See that things are unstable, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. What you're going to see, you're going to be challenged by the practice. If you're doing it properly, it will be challenging, and it will force you to reevaluate your attachments, and it'll force you to become more flexible as you see that your expectations and your rigidity of mind, your clinging to things, is causing you suffering. I wouldn't over-intellectualize the goal, because practically you're going to experience so much that what you should be focusing on is dealing with and learning about what you experience. But yeah, I
Thank
mean,
you.
that's basically what you're saying, so you're fine. I guess I'm always wary of putting it out in words like that, but it sounds like actually you've got a good grasp on it.
Sorry, this was, I think, another part of the original question. I find it's hard to keep up with the effort to pick up the four foundations of mindfulness throughout the day. I was hoping keeping the larger purpose, motivation in mind would help me.
You see, that's what I was afraid of. You're trying to find a trick to make it easier. Anytime anyone says, "I find it hard," you've got to say, "Good, it's supposed to be hard. It's a challenge. It's meant to challenge you. Don't look for a trick. Fight with it. Work on it." You know, when it's hard, that's when the work is happening, because you're seeing it's unpredictable, it's unsatisfying, and it's uncontrollable. The practice is that way. That's what you're supposed to see. So, work on it. There's no shortcut. Trying to find a trick that makes it that helps you, it's not going to help you. Don't look for something to help you. Work on it. Be more patient, be more methodical. There's no trick. It's quite clear what you have to do. It's just we don't like the fact that it's so difficult, so we try to find a way around it, a shortcut. Don't look for shortcuts. That in and of itself is, or don't look for crutches or supports, because that in and of itself is an unwholesome mind state. It's laziness. It's common. I mean, it's not a criticism, but something you have to be wary of. There's no shortcut.
Question, and hopefully this isn't asking about a shortcut, but maybe it is. Phones with all their notifications, so distracting. When practicing daily meditation, if I hear notifications, it's not, it's not simple like hearing for other ordinary sounds. I start to get worried, anxious. Does somebody need me? Do I need to answer that? So would it be a better practice to know all of the myriad of curiosity, worried, anxious, or just turn off the phone before daily meditation?
You'd want to more look at your level in practice. For a beginner, much better to turn off the phone. When you're doing an intensive course, you don't need that distraction. You're going to find all the deep stuff anyway. But during daily life, for a continuing practitioner, I would say you're going to have to learn to deal with these things. And you're strong enough through your practice to recognize them and deal with them and to not get lost in them. So, yeah, it could, I would argue, to some extent, you would want to open yourself up to those. Now, when you're really trying to be more intensive about your practice, I would just turn off the notifications. Because the other thing is, even without the worry and so on, there's an obligation, there's a duty. And if you make a determination to focus on the meditation, you're basically saying, "I'm not going to be in contact with people," because that is a does diffuse my meditation practice. So I guess I would say when you're doing intensive practice, better to turn it off. But unless you're a beginner, for someone who's new, then I would argue probably turning it off, turning them off is the best. But if it's not intensive practice, you might want to turn them on and learn to deal with the worry.
That's pretty much what I do now, but it is challenging.
Mm-hmm. Which is good. It's supposed to be.
Yeah, it is. I recently had a major setback. I just recently got back from New Mexico, and on the way back, I lost my temper, and quite verbally, even yelling a few times. I felt all my progress and mindfulness was in vain. Is it normal to have to start over, or a feeling of starting over? I feel lousy about it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't lose mindfulness. Mindfulness is not really an aggregate quality. It's not something that gets bigger over time. That's concentration. So, and that's more what meditators build up, and they build up concentration to the extent that they think they've gained something. And then to see the mindfulness pop like a bubble, yeah, it's somewhat disappointing. Because we have expectations and we think we've gained something real when we actually haven't. But mindfulness will allow you to know that you're angry. And the fact that you're aware that you're angry, and that you're aware now that you feel lousy about it, all of that is, it's a start, you know. Being aware of these things is a sign of a mindful awareness or a mindful quality to your mind. So, you know, progress will be, yeah, getting less angry about things. But in the beginning, it's just more accepting that they're there, you know, and learning to identify them, rather than, and this is maybe where acceptance could come in, is that rather than pretending they're not there or trying to wish them away, accepting that you've got a problem and that you've got to deal with it. It's sort of a temporary acceptance, in the sense of accepting that you're going to have to deal with these things rather than just run away from them, you know, that they're still there, accepting the fact that you're not enlightened yet and you've got work to do. So I wouldn't feel discouraged about that at all. I would take it as an opportunity to deal with these emotions. When you feel bad about it, say upset, or disliking, sad, angry, frustrated, whatever. Don't think of it as a setback. It was a mistake. It was a part of the problem. You know, it was a product of the problem that you have inside. Okay, well, we know what the problem is. It's like when a plumber tries to find a clog in the drain. It's great when he finds it. Now you've found the clog. Or when a computer programmer finds a bug. They found the bug in the program. Now they just have to fix it. So you've found the bug. You just have to fix it. Alright. Well, sorry for the brevity of tonight's show, but I'll be back tomorrow. Today I also went to Mississauga, gave a short talk there to a bunch of Christians, actually. He said, he took me aside before the talk, and he's got all serious and said, I want to tell you, these are they're mostly Christians, and I thought he was going to say, and I know you've been bashing Christians lately, but he doesn't know. So I thought that's what he was going to tell me. He's going, you know, I don't want you to bash Christians. Because I'm not very friendly towards Christianity, but, you know, I can be. It was good. I think they were happy with it. I don't know. It was interesting because they're Christian, but the woman who sort of organized it, her husband and her daughter died in a car crash, and she was just, of course, devastated. And she came to the monastery there, and it was the monks there who helped her deal with her sadness, her loss, 3 years ago. And so she actually is very much impressed by Buddhism. And I think she was actually somewhat critical of, she sort of left her Christian faith because, you know, it didn't really help her, and it certainly couldn't explain why they had to die. You know. Besides, it's all part of some mythical being's plan for us. It'd be a shame to have to be stuck on that kind of meaningless belief. Alright, anyway, let's end on that note. Have a good night, everyone. Thank you, Robin, for joining me, as usual.
Thank you, Bhante. Good night.
Good night.